So this is a talk about, I hope, the philosophy of mathematics with a lot of history of one particular episode. I want to start off by thanking Juliet Kennedy and Andres Villaveses, who have been, I'm trying to write a book about this stuff, and I'm writing the introduction, and then every week or so we Skype for an hour. And so things are humming along, and this is the chapter on model theory and set theory. So Penny Matty, for those of you who aren't in the philosophy crowd, is a, well, president of ASL a couple of years ago, but the works on the philosophy of set theory. And she has a notion of the second philosopher. She says that one of the duties of the second philosopher is to adjudicate the methodological questions of mathematics. What makes for a good definition, an acceptable axiom, a dependable proof technique? And this talk is about how certain definitions are made in, were made in model theory, and how they meet these kinds of criteria. And so in particular, what I argue is that the way in which model theory has developed in the last 40 years was caused by a proposition was made which reduced the set theoretical overhead, but also provided tools for solving mathematical problems, and in addition, an organizing scheme for mathematics. Now, this is sort of the general theme of the book, but today we're going to talk about one. And this notion of entanglement is one that has some philosophical history. I'm not going to say anything about it here, but that's what I'm doing. I want to say that. And what I want to argue is that there's a deep entanglement, a really deep connection between cardinality and first-order model theory, but not between first-order model theory and cardinal arithmetic. While when we pass to infinitary logic, then the cardinal arithmetic becomes important. And basically, the feeling in the 60s was that this was a true statement about first-order model theory. And I'm going to try to explain what it is that changed that view. So, equality is always an equivalence relation. And we want to say it satisfies substitution. I think the philosophical view is this, that the indiscernibility of identicals. Just substitution axioms. But a kind of crucial role for model theory is when you define truth by induction, the interpretation of the equality function in the model is identity. Right? Now, if you were my age, you would have come up reading books in logic that talked about logic with and without equality. I don't think any of the graduate students went through that, unless, well, some of them might come in philosophy. Okay. And so this is, you know, this is the way we think. And then you can say things like, there's a finite, you know, sets are finite. So, but it's not just sets are finite. The downward Lohenheim's going, well, that's not so much involved with equality, because after all, if I don't have equality, then downward Lohenheim's going is easy. You just collapse everything. But upward Lohenheim's golem is very much about equality, and I will use Malsev's proof. Well, I mean, I've been talking for a week about what other proofs there are. But you say, I want to have a model of size kappa, and so you write down kappa constants and say they're different, and then by the compactness theorem, there's a model, and now I've got a model on kappa. But the equality is the crucial aspect of this. All right, as I said, only finite structures are kappa. Oh, sorry. All right, I think I do this. Good. I said I was going to talk about the entanglement of cardinal arithmetic and, well, so this well, extended to the ZS. Yeah, okay. So this is a quote from Shaw. He says, actually, just let people read it for 10 seconds. So there's this cycle, I think, to some extent, that in the 60s, infinitary logic was very important. It was very, very important. Went away from it. As we see now, there's a little more interest in the last 10 years, through AECs. Those of you who aren't familiar with it, two cardinal theorems should be a black box for about one more slide. But here's, it's a little hard to follow the pronouns here. When Jensen started to deal with gap n and two cardinal theorems, they were the epitome of model theory. And then when I stopped doing it, nobody was interested anymore. And then Shalah says, I sympathize, although model theorists have reasonable excuses. One is they want ZFC provable theorems, and as I'll say in a minute, this is set theory. And the other is, it isn't clear if there were any anymore. Now that, I think, Shalhoub's just wrong about. There's really a lot of work. You can read about two cardinal theorems. I just saw five or six papers on the web that were published in the last couple of years by set theorists. So my questions are, I'm going to try to explain, why in 1970 should be strong links of even first-order model theory with cardinal arithmetic axiomatic set theory? And then the second question is, why had these links evaporated in 5 years or something? So what does this apparent dependence mean? So the Langhans-Golomb theorem we started with, this is something that seems philosophically interesting, but Fott said, well, let's just be a little more general. What happens if I have a model and a definable subset? Can I vary them the same way for the models? I can make them be any cardinality I want. What if I have a definable subset? Can it be any cardinality I want? Are there limitations? And this gets a formal kind of notion. A two cardinal model is a structure with a definable set of strictly smaller cardinality. And we say that a theory admits kappa lambda if there's a model of size kappa, the model of size kappa and the definable subset has power lambda. And the question is, suppose I have a kappa lambda model and you give me some other pair of cardinals where one's bigger than the other, under what conditions can I move this? So, what quadrupers? And when I say it's a big question, I mean for maybe 5 or 6 years, this was the central question the model theorists were working on. One of the central questions today. And I'm not going to try to go into any of the details here, but the main, the sort of fundamental theorem due to independent range of, due to Morley, is using the Gardner-Schwatto theorem, so you need to have replacement to do it. Chang's theorem uses GCH, versions, other versions use V equals L. Jensen introduces the notion of a morass specifically for this purpose. Errors cardinals show up. But then I just had this in by 1982, Forman is still doing things, showing connections with large cardinals, and that's still going on. So this is what Jensen was thinking about, and thinking, this is a lot of stuff, connection between set theory and model theory. And now I want to say, why don't we do that now? Why is it that we can now have people learning getting PhDs in model theory who don't know what V equals L? That's a different world. Well, it's not a different world. I didn't either, but it was a different world if you were at a fancy place. So the point is, here's two theorems that are shown in ZFC. If T is stable, or actually written down much later by Tim Bayes, a philosopher, for an O-minimal theory, every transfer holds. And the point is that we've changed the question. The set theorist asks, for which cardinals do you have this property transferring for every theory? And the model theorist asks, well, which theories does it transfer for every cardinal? The first question is just immensely harder. While this question becomes answerable once Shalah tells us, well, here's how you split up the theories. So, a theory is stable in a cardinal chi if the number of types over a set of size chi is at most chi. That is, the number of non-isomorphic one-point extensions of a set. And now it's a theorem, 71 or 70, something like that. That theory is a theory is either stable in every cardinal, stable above the continuum, stable exactly when lambda v omega equals lambda, or never stable.
Now this is for countable theories. There are related results for uncountable, but I'm not going to deal with them.
So this, I think, is the introduction to Sachs's model theory book. Central notions of model theory are absolute, and absoluteness, unlike cardinality, is a logical concept. That is why model theory does not founder on the rock of undecidability, the generalized continuum hypothesis, and why the Warsh conjecture is decidable. So the Warsh conjecture is the notion that categoricity and power. Yeah, so that's
Morley had already done that a long time before.
So what do I mean when I say these things are absolute? Omega stability is the same thing as saying Morley rank is defined as a pi 1-1. Superstability is the same thing as sort of D rank is defined. That's a pi 1-1 property. Stability is actually an arithmetic property.
So these are all statements that are solidly absolute by Schoenfeld absoluteness.
So as I said a minute ago, every complete theory falls into one of these four classes, and then the unstable. I mean, what people have been doing for the last 10 or 15 years is, 20 actually, is doing a detailed study of the things that are not, that are unstable. There's now simplicity, NIP, tree property, MTP2, whatever. There's a whole family of refinements of this which are studied both from the kind of standpoint that Shalal would come up, let's see how we can explore this white space on the map, but also because they deal with important mathematical notions. So valued fields have NIP, for example. So I'm sort of coming back this way. Why are these definitions chosen? And on the one hand, they reduced some the hypotheses that you had to do to get the results. And the other is, well, so this gives you, in the stability class, now you have a notion of dimension. You get a way of classifying models, doing the kind of things that algebraists do in general. Gives detailed information about the fine structure of definable sets. You have these ranks which magically turn out to be what the algebraic geometers were doing. The fact that Vey's rank and Morley's rank were the same was a great surprise 15 years after Morley had done it using, you're thinking of stone spaces and Cantor rank kind of thing. These dimensions have, and so working through this, there are all the applications that many of the people in this room are working with using these kinds of techniques of algebraic types. Interaction of dimensions. And the kind of point that I'm not going to deal much with today about organization is that one can find in totally different areas of mathematics, you find the similarity that
oh, I formalize this notion. I do some kind of theory for differential fields, or I do some kind of theory for random graphs. So these are ones that are not going to be the same. But the and then there's some syntactic property in this theory, which is the same. You have the order property in Z to the omega, not Z to the omega, in Q plus, even though you don't, you know, not the ordering isn't there to begin with. You have to do some work and look at some of four squares. But then you see, oh, here is a formula that has this order property. And this is sort of a hint of the other end of this. So those who aren't model theorists, this should be sort of a black box. But it's saying there are these types. These are ways of looking at pieces of the model. And they either interact or they don't. If I say, if I have this non-orthogonality, that says these guys there's some recognizable connection between these two parts of the model, some kind of a map from one end to the other. But this is something that happens eventually. Here, the almost orthogonal is, this says, suppose you have a situation where eventually, that is, if I name enough independent elements of each type, then I will find the connection. But if I just look at one element from each one, I can't see it. And Ruchowski says, if that happens, now these are purely model theoretic notions, then this happens in one of a few ways. There's a definable group here, a type definable group, and it's acting just by that multiplication. It's going to be any group. It acts on itself. Or you have an algebraically closed field, and it's acting either on the affine line as GLM or as on the projective line as PGL. Not in PGL 2. Okay? So the point of this is that these abstract model theoretic notions, somehow the mathematics is really there. The classical notions of group actions appear from notions, from definitions that when they were made, there was no conception they would have this kind of a and so you know, you find specific classical groups, and then all the kind of work of, you know, Ruchowski and Zilber and so on is using these kind of techniques. So there's lots of interactions with number theory and Diophantine geometry that come out of this particular theorem, and lots of extensions of it. So now I want to turn the other way. So what I've said so far is, first order logic gets along great in ZFC. It's really much more connected with classical mathematics than it is with set theory. There's still some combinatorics there, but I'm not talking about that just now. But now, what about extensions of ZFC? So why would you use an extension? Now, this is the first reason. If I don't know how to prove a theorem, but I can add a hypothesis and get one, I'm ahead of the game. But it might be that having done that, you can see that you didn't really need the set theoretic hypothesis. So the paper that Rami and Will just wrote, they abstract this independence relation, satisfying the kinds of properties that you have first order logic. Well, now we're talking about an abstract element of the class, and they do it in first order, but in analogy to an earlier result about L kappa kappa, where kappa was strongly compact. Perhaps you can just get rid of that hypothesis. So in the proof of Ax Cochin in the 60s, the GCH was used. Right, because it said ultra powers of, because it used the property that ultra powers of elementary equivalent structures are isomorphic. In their paper it said, oh, but the result we're after is absolute. So it was okay to use the set theory. And then The second thing was, well, I guess I've got these reversed, sorry. They said, you'll just use the absoluteness. What also happened was 5 years later, Shalhoub proved this theorem in ZFC. So in both cases, we had something that apparently used GCH, but there were two different ways of seeing why it wasn't really there. And we use this note, consistency may imply truth. What I mean is you find some model of set theory that shows the consistency of your result. Now, if it's absolute, this is an example of that. But a more sophisticated version is, well, it isn't absolute, but I will do some construction on the model of set theory so that I get a model of set theory where what I'm talking about is absolute between that model and the universe, and I prove the theorem that way. So this is an active tool right now. So let me quickly say what an abstract elementary class is. It's a collection of structures and a relationship of I call it strong submodel. Some notion of what it means to be a nice submodel. Might be an elementary submodel. Might just be substructure in the ordinary sense. Might be some substructure in an elementary, in an infinitary logic. But it's looking abstractly at this notion. And then basically you write down Janssen's axioms for homogeneous universal models in the 50s. But with a free variable for what the notion of elementary substructure is. Now, this is this was in Lamy-Sartre's what's called a coherence axiom. It just says, if this is sitting strongly in the top, and this is sitting strongly in the top, then this sits strongly in here. It's a kind of Tarski-Frank condition. Secondly, closure under direct limits, or as category theorists would call it, closure under colimits, and a downward Lorentz colimit. And so this is an accessible category from the category set. It's a particularly strong notion of accessible category. So there are some examples. So now I want to give an example of a theorem about infinitary logic. So here, the way I've written this, I really went very few here. So that means less, in aleph n plus 1, there's less than 2 to the aleph n models. And excellence is like Alex Kluxman's talk a couple of days ago, that you have n amalgamation for every n. He was doing that fine after that. And Lamy. So you need the set theory to prove that having few models up to alpha omega implies excellence. And excellence is a condition on countable models, that you have all the n amalgamations of countable structures, and in a kind of unique display of Lamy. Okay. And then theorems in ZFC is that an excellent Clark class has model in every right now. So remember, I'm talking now about L omega 1 omega. There is no upwards Lorentz colimit there. Another thing that I've been playing with is, get something that stops at exactly which cardinal it stops at, maybe 11 at aleph 17. So. First of all, such a class has models in every cardinal. And then Morley's theorem holds for it. It's categorical in one incountable cardinal, categorical in all. So this is sort of the most complete result of getting back and getting Morley's theorem as close as you can, and it's completely tight. Did I have that here this year? Huh, okay. Maybe it'll show up in a minute, but there are theorems by the counterexamples by Hart and Shalhoub, proved a bit by myself and Alex Kolesnikov, that you can stop this at any finite alpha. And then there's these eventual categoricity theorems of Boney and Vasey, one saying that
if you have a strongly compact cardinal and a Lorentz whole number of k is less than that, then the categorical and some successor cardinal beyond that, then the categorical null in all larger powers. And Sebastian basically removes this plus, which is a not at all an easy test. This thing has been sitting around in various forms with the successor for 20 years. Not as good a result, but weaker results that all use the successor. And not only and now the successor has been removed. It's a serious effort. So one way we might think about this is that for first order logic, there's an exceptional cardinal. Aleph zero, Jalal always says, well, this is the special case. It doesn't tell you much. The things become uniform above. So Morley's theorem is an obvious example of this. These theorems show that at least if we go up to a strong compact cardinal, after that we get the kind of uniformity. But we don't actually know what's exceptional. I mean, it below the first strongly compact, but nobody actually has any constructions of things that go bad beyond Beth omega 1. So there's a big gap in there. And the question of, from a philosophical standpoint, what does this world look like? You have a situation where there are propositions here that are mathematical. They aren't just combinatorial. Maybe I want to use the word algebraic. You have all this kind of structure theory for stable classes. You have a way now to discuss this so that you know that it works eventually. You know, there are a few failures at the bottom, but where's the gap? Where does it block? What is really exceptional? So I think about this as a paradigm shift that I think took place in the 70s. And there's actually two steps, which I think is very important for philosophers to think about. There's an awful lot of work in contemporary philosophy around second order logic and categoricity. There's only one model. Now that, to the model theorists, is just a question we never think about. Because there isn't any non-trivial model theory for second order logic. And so making this distinction, I'll break it up this way, second order logic, and I put infinite order logical AECs in the middle, and first order logic. But, while these things were known as being different, it's in the 70s that you really get the breakup that, yes, for the first time, there is a technical subject of model theory, beginning with Morley, and it's about first order logic. And if you choose these logic, you're making a trade-off, right? There's a lot more expressive power in the larger logic, but then you can't control the building of models the way you can in the less expressive logics. But the second point is the distinction between studying logics and studying theories. And I think this actually comes about in two stages. Already with Robinson and with Tarski in the 50s, you begin to think about, theories that are model complete, right? This is a property of theories. Or theories that are pi 2 axiomatizable. So you're getting this kind of a switch, but it really happens with the stability hierarchy. I recall at the 1974 International Congress of Mathematicians, Shalah first asked me to explain. He said, people have trouble understanding. Explain to this guy the answer to this question about what model theory is about. And I said, in model theory, we talk about the differences between models. And
And he said, no, you've got it wrong. It's about theories. It's the classification of theories, not the description of different models of the same theory. And, you know, maybe it was that traumatic event that makes me realize that this is the real paradigm shift. So, and again, how do you classify theories? And the sort of the part that is new in the 70s is that the decision is not whether there's sort of rough notions of how complex the formulas are, but do you have a way of describing the models? That's what makes it a good classification. And so this leads to the divorce from axiomatic set theory on the one hand for first order logic, and on the other to these many fruitful interactions with other areas of mathematics, which of course would be another talk and is another chapters in the book. And then coming back to infinitary logic, you get more expressive power. Maybe, I think I'm sort of in with what Rami was saying in the end. It takes years to understand this thing. And as we try to investigate, I think, structures in other cardinalities, we will find ways of using infinitary logic to describe distinctions that we just haven't thought about yet. And then we will see that this is a tool that is really helpful for what, I mean, there'll be mathematical notions that we will then want to use. Okay, so there are, well, five, but this is really one long paper that's been split up for publication purposes. These papers are on my website. Anybody that wants to talk about them, so. Any questions? Yeah?
Are you going to write at all about the applications of model theory to set theory?
Oh, no, not really. But I mean, that's a good point. I mean, the that's certainly what was going on, you know, part of this entanglement. And maybe I should say a little bit about this. It's, you know, things like silver indiscernibles and realizing O sharp as the collection of indiscernibles in the model of the immeasurable cardinal. Those were model theoretic ideas coming out in set theory. But I don't know enough set theory to say anything very sensible about this. I'm not going to.
You are thinking only about divorce of set theory with model theory, not in mathematics in general.
Right. I'm just saying, when I say this divorce, I mean that that in the early 70s, there was this worry that you weren't going to be able to do model theory without doing set theory at the same time. And that just turned out not to be true. But it was certainly something that seemed very plausible in 1970.
Oh, so of course now there is again sort of back the connection between model theory and descriptive set theory. Well, it's not axiomatic set theory, but still.
No, that's certainly right. And in fact, I mean, this is probably something I should be thinking about, because there are various parts of the fine kind of and this isn't the things you're thinking about. There are fine parts of the stability hierarchy where one brings in descriptive set theory. But also reactions. Models
and not to mention Boltz conjecture.
Well, I mean, that's another question that I can make precise. So the question is Boltz conjecture a set theoretic condition or a model theory? And
And here is a discriminant. If somebody finally gets around to proving Watt's conjecture is true for superstable theories and fails for a stable theory, then you've shown that the model theory. And you know, this isn't a pipe dream. On the other hand, it's a lot less likely than it was 25 years ago when it seemed like that was about to happen.
Formalizing model theory outside of the category of sets? So that's something that I've wondered about.
So what do
well,
you
I mean, we are the structures that we're dealing with are set essentially.
Yeah, right.
So they're, they're elements of some model
right.
Sense. But is it possible to maybe relax that condition to allow objects of a category to then internalize the Tarski truth evaluation within some category? That's something that I've been thinking about. I don't know if it's sensible.
On the one hand, McIntyre has this paper in 2000 that sort of says, well, we're all going to do that, but doesn't tell you much about how you're going to do it. And on the other hand, things like AECs do it the other way. You look at the category of models, but throw away the syntax. You don't know what a definable set is anymore. You're just looking at the class of structures.
Right.
So, I mean, yeah, so that's not what you're after. I'm just saying that there and I don't know quite what, yeah, I mean.
You mean
this
how to internalize the logic within the category?
Right.
Okay.
I mean, maybe, plausibly, this kind of homotopic type theory would be a way of looking at that you would be building on a categorical foundation. But I'm not. It would mean something. Well, just as when they study algebraic topology, they aren't going through the category of sets and looking at the way algebraic topology was done 50 years ago and saying they're going directly. And so maybe there would be a way to think of model theory in the same notion. I don't know.
Don't you see the directions in model theory today where we
I'm sorry, a little louder. Come.
Don't you see the directions in model theory today where we have the first order stuff with the stability theory, and then we have these abstract elementary classes where they do need set theory?
Well, yeah, I see that distinction. Yeah, I thought I was saying that. Yeah. But whether the I also think that there may eventually be more connections with the abstract case to the, because Morley and Saho and Morley had algebraic closed fields in mind, but they were not thinking about doing the mathematics. And in the early 70s, we started looking. I mean, McIntyre was maybe the first one, but people start looking at what are the Alaplan categorical theories of groups? Right? But it was all, but we're just finding examples of these things. They aren't. And then it began to go in the other direction, and then Rushovsky's theorem, I put it, because it's really sort of a crushing point. But that direction really became interesting later on, and we just don't have enough experience, in my view, with using infinitary logics to have yet figured out what we want to describe.
I wanted to say great thing with your talk. It was really awesome analysis, and also I didn't know the history so much, so that was great.
Just another example of model theory applying to set theory.
Yeah.
There's a sort of cardinality of the invariance of the continuum question.
Yes.
You heard about it?
Well, I don't know any details, but I know there's.
Yeah.
But how do you connect it with model theory?
So it turns out to be related to properties of models with the Kiesler order or something.
Oh yeah. So you're marrying
on the Kiesler order.
Yeah. Right. That's right. Yeah. No, that's right. That's.
Yeah, no, that is a good connection. Oh, now, does this actually work or not? Oh, what? No. No, 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 we've got a half an hour off.
11:30, no?
It's 11:30,
yeah.
So how do I stop it?